Welcome to the Flow Tracy Monday Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 2:23 p.m. and that is Central Time. And today is Friday. It's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes on May 12th. I thought we'd kick off with the spread between the 10-year and the 3-month yield in the U.S. It's down to negative 166 basis points, which is a bit off the lows, but not in an especially dynamic manner. And looking at this very long-term chart, we can definitely see that the last time we had anything even remotely close to this kind of inversion, it was right around the end of the inflationary cycle in the early 1980s. And in fact, the yield curve spread is now more inverted than it was during the oil crisis in the early 1970s. So I think that's rather important. Now, I think it's also it's certainly worth highlighting that the most convincing signal from the yield curve spread is not so much that one yield curve becomes inverted, but when lots of inversions occur right across the curve. And we can see, for example, between the spread between the 10-year and the 2-year, it's also heavily inverted, although it is well off the lows already. But then, of course, these aren't the only kinds of yield curve. So if we look at the spread between the 10-year and the 2-year on high yield bonds, well, then we can also see that there has been a really profound process of contraction. Now, this yield curve spread doesn't tend to become inverted, although it did become inverted in 2010. So it's not unprecedented, but we are at about as low as it has generally tended to come. Then let's think about the muni sector. Now, I think it's important to highlight that municipals, they can raise local taxes to pay down their debts, and they've generally tended to do that in times of stress. But we are also in a rather heavily inverted yield curve scenario for municipal bonds. So we have inversions across maturities. We have inversions across different kinds of bonds. And those inversions continue to become more inverted. Then we can think about the outlook for money. And I think one of the things that we think about right at the beginning of the chart seminar is to first think about the very simple truism, which is that in a bull market, it's easier to make money. It's easier to make money when there's a lot of it about. And it is more difficult to make money when there isn't. Well, the growth of money supply, well, it exploded during the pandemic, going up to 25% on a year-over-year basis. Now, that's a profound jump in the supply of cash. So it's not perhaps that surprising to think that we had a really big run-up in asset prices, and the stock market and property markets did exceptionally well. But now it is negative, and it's falling at 4% year-over-year. Now, of course, it's coming off of an exceptionally high base. So we also need to look at the absolute version. And just simply looking at this, we can see that there, in fact, hasn't been an occasion when the supply of cash went negative. And this is a clear peak. So just by virtue of the fact that the supply of money is rolling over means it's going to be more difficult to make money in the markets. Then because of that, when we think about money market assets, well, with high rates or rates where they are today, then the demand for money market funds has exploded. So it's gone up rather significantly since the beginning of 2021, going from about $4.5 trillion and now at about $5.3 So that's $800 billion has been put to work in money market funds over the space of 2 years. Then, of course, we have the Fed funds rate, which has been going up in a very aggressive manner over the last year and is now right in the region of where it peaked in 2007. Now, I think this is most particularly this is noteworthy for one important reason, and it is clearly that the long-term sequence of lower rally highs has been broken. Now, of course, this was a failed upside break in two, 2000 and or just 2000, sorry, and then subsequently went to a new low. Well, you can't very well go below zero, or at least not easily. And now we are at a point where the Fed funds rate has clearly broken upwards. So I think that the most likely scenario is that when they do cut rates, we're not going back down to zero. We could easily have a good sized rally in bond prices as those yields contract. But then subsequently, the yield is quite likely to move higher, and that this long-term trend of disinflation has ended. And I think this is perhaps the most important trend of all, that if we really start thinking about the long term, that we're not going to see yields coming down from 20 to zero over the course of the next 20 years. That it is much more likely we're going to be in a volatile interest rate environment for the foreseeable future, where they will surprise on the upside during periods of contraction and surprise on the downside during occasional recessions. That it is also unlikely that we're going to have a generational long period of advance in stocks where we get bull markets that last for a decade. I think it is much more likely that we're going to have bull markets that last for maybe 2 or 3 years, because the driver of profound liquidity growth isn't going to be as powerful. Now, of course, that is on the assumption that we do not move into a much more tense geopolitical environment where governments have no choice but to print the money they require to build the necessary infrastructure and war machinery for a prolonged war effort. So there's obviously caveats to any significant longer term forecast, but certainly the breaking of the long term downtrend is one of the most important factors that we have. Now, then let's think about the banking sector. Well, banks generally tend to borrow in the short term, lend in the long term. And the S&P 500 banks index remains in a very clear and consistent downtrend. It has encountered resistance in the region of the lower side of the overhead trading range, and it is still trending downwards. Now, before we move on, let's just simply look at what's in that index, because now we have these big companies like JP Morgan, Bank of America, Citigroup. Now, what these are generally referred to as money center banks. So they're the big deposit holders. They have huge deposits upon which to leverage their businesses. And when money center banks are underperforming like this, well, then that tells us that the availability of credit in the wider market is contracting and contracting quickly. So the problem, of course, is that it's very easy to see the longer term negative consequences of an inverted yield curve, underperforming banks, negative money supply growth. And then to say, well, it's absolutely inevitable there's going to be a recession. But as long as yield curve spreads are inverting, then stocks generally tend to hold up reasonably well. And that's exactly what we've seen. And the S&P 500 is still trading above its 200-day moving average. Now, it was in negative territory today and down about 0.5%. But I don't think anyone is going to be particularly worried about that particular development. And there is obviously a great deal of enthusiasm around the artificial intelligence theme. Now, I think it's very important to highlight that a lot of the innovations that are now being talked about breathlessly with regard to artificial intelligence have been around for several years already. And I was at the MIT, what do they call it, Emerging Tech conference last week. And NVIDIA had a presentation where they were talking about the applications of artificial intelligence in drug discovery. And that presentation hasn't changed much in 5 years. I was at another one of those conferences in 2016, and they were talking a very similar game. So when we think then about what is new, well, the large language models, where we have these chatbots and they are basically siphoning the internet to come up with tidbits. So that obviously is very impressive, and then the writing style and the absence of grammatical errors and the sense that they're making in answers, those are all incredibly impressive. And there is certainly going to be a major productivity enhancing trend as a result of these artificial intelligence tools. So I think that that's inevitable, and I think that it's probably going to take a little bit longer than a lot of people anticipate. But certainly, investors want to get a piece of it now, and Microsoft has rebounded very impressively. It was up in a very dynamic manner 3 weeks ago, and it has continued to bounce from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And as long as it's doing that, well, then we're still in a bull market overall. And Google has demoed its own version of AI in the last 24 hours, and the share was up in a very dynamic manner this week, so it has now also broken a more than year-long downtrend. And then Salesforce has announced that they will be incorporating AI into their labor-saving devices. So the share was up in a dynamic manner earlier this week and gave up some of that advance in here today. But then let's just think about what about all those companies that are not right at the forefront of the AI revolution? And most particularly, what about those companies that have a piece of it, but are not running as quickly with it as some of the more established and better capitalized companies? So, when we think about that, I think this was something that really stood out to me at that AI conference, that there are lots of companies, even one that has a ticker AI, are just not performing. Then, within the cloud computing sector, certainly, the rebound that we've seen, for example, in Salesforce is encouraging. But the cloud computing ETF is really just beginning to build support, and it has held a sequence of higher reaction lows, but the price today is pretty much where it was back in October. Now, I think that there is a very strong possibility that we're going to see a very significant winnowing process within the technology sector. And instead of every company doing well, we're going to get a very clear divergence between the winners and the losers. And I think when we think about cloud computing, this is more likely than not because there are three distinct parts to it. There's been a huge build-out of logistics and data centers. And I think when we look then at this winnowing process, so let's just focus first on cloud computing. You have the kinds of companies that manage the databases. You have the kinds of companies that manage the linkages between the various bits and pieces of software that a company is using. And then you have the companies that are providing the user interface, which are what we might describe as the front-facing part of the business. So one is the kind of thing that the user will be familiar with And Salesforce definitely has that. But so does SAP. But then there are other companies that do the bits and pieces that the front end user doesn't use and are totally essential, but largely homogeneous. And there are lots of different companies that do the nuts and bolts bits of cloud computing. Some are offering intelligence on it, and some are offering a somewhat better widget for analyzing all of that data as it comes through. Well, it seems to me to be very likely that what we're going to see is that the larger, better capitalized companies are just going to do the middle part of the cloud computing themselves. So that is really problematic for a company like Twilio. And the share is continuing to trend downwards. Now, in this environment where we have seen a really impressive rebound for larger companies and a reasonable range and support building for the wider ETF, when a key constituent, one of the clear early leaders, is rolling over now and is right back on its lows from back in October, this is kind of bad news. And I think it's very good evidence of this winnowing process. Now, let's then think about Amazon. So, Amazon has been very active in developing the back end of cloud computing with its Amazon Web Services. And the share peaked in 2021, trended downwards for most of last year, and it's now right in the region of the 200-day moving average and testing the region of the 1,000-day moving average and beginning to roll over. And the big challenge for Amazon is that a lot of its customers are those smaller companies. So there's been a big build-out of processing capacity, which was at parasitic on the continued outperformance of these smaller companies. One of the primary reasons why there has been such a big jump in the number of startups is because they were able to buy services from Amazon and from Google. So they didn't have to go off and build their own data center. They didn't have to build their own warehousing. They could just do it all via Amazon and Google. But what, of course, that means is that there was an almost symbiotic relationship that Amazon was selling one thing and then became more dependent on those customers. Those customers were dependent on continued liquidity being available for them to run loss-making operations in the hope that they might eventually become profitable, even though that they're paying out half their revenue to companies like Amazon and Google. With the big decline that we've had in these smaller companies, well, this winnowing process is going to weigh on the growth of a business like Amazon, which is why it's still in this medium-term downtrend. Now, let's just then think about the winnowing process in the electric vehicle sector, because Rivian was one of those companies that Amazon was putting money into, and it's very likely that they're going to be asked to put more money into it, or perhaps even just take the thing over. At least Rivian has about $11 billion in cash and only about $3 billion in debt, but they have negative free cash flow of $6 billion this year. So, unless things turn around in 2024, the company will run out of money. But that's a better situation than we have for Lucid. Now, Lucid's another company with a big brother, but this one's in Saudi Arabia. So there is a likelihood that they could run out of money this year. They've only got about $2.9 billion in cash, and they're due to lose about $3.3 billion this year. And that's obviously problematic. And the share is also right on its lows and still trending downwards. Fisker never really caught fire, and it is also likely to run out of money within the next 12 months. So there's obviously a winnowing process here, but at least it has bounced off its lows. But this doesn't look like a recovery scenario. Now, I thought it was interesting that Faraday Futures is now called Faraday Futures Intelligent Electric, and they're also likely to run out of money. And the news last week that Hanhai Precision, our Foxconn, are pulling out of their manufacturing agreement with the company, there is a strong likelihood that it will simply cease to exist. Of course, these are all U.S. companies, and Tesla is the big performer. But of course, Tesla is also not the only electric vehicle manufacturer. And the reality is that Chinese companies have an edge in their development of the technology and manufacturing capacity. Tesla is going through a recall of just about every one of its vehicles in China right now. Now, of course, the technology has improved, so they can do that recall by over-the-air software updates. They don't have to bring in every single vehicle. But the share is still trending downwards, and it has not yet been able to push back above the 1,000-day moving average. I think that there is a very strong likelihood that it's going to be ranging for a pretty prolonged period of time. Then we can think about companies like Peloton, idiosyncratic in that they have this subscription model where they charge more than a gym membership for video participation in spin classes. But the reality is that that's rather expensive relative to a gym membership. And more often than not, people are really enthused by these kinds of pieces of exercise equipment for a reasonably short period of time, and then it turns into an expensive clothes horse in the corner of somebody's room. And Peloton went through a spate of acquisitions, probably spent too much money on acquiring exercise equipment competitors, and now the share is trending downwards. There's a strong likelihood that it will eventually run out of money. And again, this is another company. This time it has 870 million and is losing 440 million this year. So this is a result of tightening credit. A lot of these business models were very much dependent on access to liquidity. And then we have a company like Lyft. So Lyft was a clear competitor with Uber and they lost. So the share is now trending downwards. And it still has a PE of 72. But the big challenge here is that the business model is impacted, and Lyft is generally now cheaper than Uber, but it's not making any money off of it, and but probably not going to go bust in the short term. And if we contrast that with Uber, well, Uber is doing just about everything now in the delivery business, everything from ride hailing to food deliveries in dark kitchens, and the share at least has held a sequence of higher reaction lows since June of last year. But again, this is a very clear, or I think there's clear evidence of winnowing, that of all of the promise of technology, that what we are going to see during the impending recession is a winner takes all kind of environment. And that is, of course, why there is this continued focus on the largest companies. Then, of course, then you have a company like Apple, where it is testing the sequence of higher major, excuse me, lower major rally highs, and competing with deposit takers. So, in conjunction with Goldman Sachs, they are offering deposit rates in the order of about 4.1%. And that's something that a lot of people will find very attractive, that they'll be able to commit funds on their phone and that they'll be able to earn interest rather easily. Of course, it's really bad news for the regional banks. It's bad news for the bigger banks. And then I think it's when we think about tightening liquidity overall, well, we have the very clear underperformance of the alternative asset managers. I saw an article before I started recording, and I thought it was really interesting that you've got private lenders are hiring restructuring pros. So companies like Blackstone and Bain and Barings, and HPS Investment Partners, they anticipate that there are going to be more bankruptcies, that they're going to default on more property debt than they anticipate having to enter potentially lengthy negotiations about how that debt is going to be restructured. It's really not good news for the wider commercial property environment. Now, you had the CEO of Brookfield talking yesterday and saying that a lot of the problems that they've had with defaulting on properties in Washington and in New Jersey, New York, and Los Angeles were isolated incidences, and that they own upwards of 7,000 properties, and a lot of them are still in prime locations. And they're likely to be highly desirable, and that every company makes the odd bad decision. And all of that is true. And there's also the point that they are going to be able to probably refinance it at rates that are reasonably similar to where those loans were originally taken out because rates were higher back then. But one thing that wasn't really mentioned was the capital appreciation that commercial property has had over the course of the last 15 years. Because we've been through this generational period of exceptionally easy money, low interest rates, and volumes of cash being printed that were previously unimaginable, then the prices that these pieces of property have commanded have been exceptional. But I think it's also particularly noteworthy that at the volume of cash that was printed during the pandemic is still sloshing around. And this is one of the primary reasons why inflationary pressures aren't coming down faster, because there's just so much cash around. And that means that it's going to take longer for interest rates to go up, to stay up, in order to really bring inflation under control. And I think it is very arguable whether that can be done in one cycle. I think it is much more likely that inflation is going to stay higher for longer because of that volume of cash, that a recession is going to take place, that in response to that, central banks will then have to cut interest rates, and that they'll have to increase the supply of cash, which will then further exacerbate the inflationary problem, which means that they will not be able to hold rates down for a prolonged period. And it means then that commercial property prices could easily come lower over time. And that is the primary reason why Brookfield is trending downwards. And I think it is also the primary reason why Blackstone is. They were very fortunate to have the foresight to buy large numbers of residential properties in 2009 and 10 and 11. And then the share went up like a rocket in 2020 and all the way through 2021. And not least because there was this huge move in, excuse me, real estate prices. Well, now the share is trending downwards and still in a downtrend overall. Now it has paused in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, just like it has done on several occasions. But I think there is still more downside here. the issues with commercial property have not been solved. But it was a real testament to just how much cash is floating around that luxury prices in London have begun to recover and are starting to command higher asking prices once more. But that's a clear feature of money chasing yield. And there's still a great deal of cash sloshing around. And of course, what that then also means is that until we actually see evidence of a contraction and yield curve spreads start to push higher, then it is likely that the stock markets will be reasonably steady, even if the breadth of the market is deteriorating. So when we look at the advanced decline line for the NYSE, it's trending, well, it's testing the succession of higher reaction lows in the 200-day moving average. And I think that it's likely that it's going to break lower. We've definitely seen a really significant narrowing of breadth in the advanced decline line for the Nasdaq, and it is very clearly trending downwards now. Now, it's not at a high absolute level, and this narrowing breadth, or I guess the lack of abundant of wide breadth in the performance of the Nasdaq hasn't really been a factor for a really very lengthy period of time. But this degree of narrowing breadth is something that's rather different. We haven't seen a decline like this since 2007. So I think it is meaningful that we're getting a real winnowing process going on in the stock market, because eventually the winnowing process will just cut away at the number of shares that can perform. So we have a lot of enthusiasm around artificial intelligence and a lot of promise that it will be the sector that will drive productivity growth over the course of the next bull market. And I think that there is at least some truth to that it will do that. But that doesn't mean that it is going to rescue the market from a recession. In fact, we might get more wide-scale adoption of artificial intelligence as a result of a recession. And that would also then potentially at least help to ease some of the labor difficulties. One of the biggest challenges right now is that lots of countries have labor mismatches. There are hundreds of thousands of migrants walking into the USA every month, and that is going to improve the demographics, but it isn't going to improve the skill base. And I think that is also an issue for several European countries, where there's a steady trickle of immigrants coming in from Africa, but that do not have the educational wherewithal to compete in the market. And we're still in a geopolitically tense environment. We're still in an environment where lots of people feel like they've been left behind and are politically agitating for greater distribution. And I think that's certainly an issue in terms of governance and friendliness for markets. Now, when we then think about the outlook for money printing, well, the dollar index has steadied this week because inflationary pressures are still firm, and that is supporting the view that interest rates aren't going to come down soon. So, because the dollar index has steadied, then gold prices have paused, and both silver and platinum have pulled back in pretty dynamic manners. And gold is still hovering here around the 2000 level, but it hasn't really improved from it, and it hasn't broken down through it either. I don't think we can discount the possibility that it will break below $2,000 simply because it is overbought in the short term, and it did race to get up to this level. I still think that the most benign possible scenario is that gold will continue to hold in that 2000 level. But silver had a big downward dynamic yesterday, and that is certainly peaking, or it's marking a peak of at least near-term significance, and certainly holds out the possibility that it will come back down and test the region of the 200-day, if not the 1,000-day moving average, and that would be at least another dollar on the downside. But I think these are just pauses to renew following a very strong period of performance, and that ultimately that gold will be one of the better hedges against money printing. So when we think about gold over the long term, it's been ranging for the last 3 years. And now we're in the region of the peak from back in 2011, and it has spent a good long time around here. And it has bounced from the 1,000-day moving average, and we had a failed downside break from the range. So we're right now right back at the upper side of the range and getting some consolidation. And I think this is all it is some consolidation prior to the price breaking higher and the dollar eventually trending downwards. Now, the trend of the dollar tends to be, a dollar index at least, tends to be biblical. And there's 7 years, 7 good years and 7 bad years, and well, it's been going up now for 8 years, so that is certainly long in the tooth from the longer term cycle, and it would imply that the dollar will trend downwards over the balance of the decade. If that's true, then gold will extend a breakout in due course and then potentially double, if not triple, over the rest of this decade. And if that occurs, it will be a clear benefit for the gold miners. So the gold miners look quite like silver, that they broke the sequence of war rally highs and are now consolidating. So there is certainly the potential that we get a little weaker action, and that would provide the next attractive buying opportunity. Gold is being bought by central banks around the world because they want to get a hedge against the dollar. They don't want to be overly reliant on the US dollar because the US took the unprecedented step of confiscating Russia's foreign currency reserves. So any country that could potentially fall victim to opprobrium from the USA is now looking at alternatives, and that's going to be very front and center as a discussion for South Africa. So the South African rand made a new all-time low this week. Now, it was a little steadier in here today, but this is a clear trend, and it's a big breakout. And the entire kerfuffle is about the fact that a ship was loaded with arms. Or a Russian ship was loaded with arms in South Africa last week, and there weren't any clear records of where it went. But the reality is that South Africa has tried to be unaligned, but selling arms to Russia is probably a bit too much for NATO, and there's obviously the potential that there will be sanctions levied against South Africa, or a more difficult environment placed upon it by NATO. But then, of course, it depends on how belligerent South Africa will get in defending their right to do as they please as an independent nation. And obviously, everyone knows what happened with Russia. So then it would obviously be a real problem if they confiscated the reserves of another country without the same kind of threat to European security as the invasion of Ukraine. And the message is pretty clear for lots of governments that whatever else they're doing, they shouldn't leave their reserves within arm's reach of the USA, because you never know what's going to happen in future, and you might wake up in the morning and your reserves have been removed. And that's one of the drivers behind the gold market. But South Africa is in dire straits here, that they're having difficulty keeping the lights on, and now they are running into trouble with NATO. So then the South African ETF is trending downwards and pulling back very acutely from the region of the 200-day moving average in here today. Well, I thought it was most particularly interesting that while South Africa is running into issues, the Nifty index is appreciating in US dollars and bouncing from the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and in local currency terms is a lot closer to its all-time highs. And India is importing more Russian oil than ever. It's now become the biggest exporter of diesel to Europe, which makes India look like an energy exporter, which is a long way from reality. But nobody's kicking up a fuss about the volume of oil that India is importing because it's seen as a vital bulwark against China's expansionism in Asia. And then, of course, India is also likely to be one of the primary beneficiaries of migrating manufacturing capacity in, and I think it's accurate to state that the majority of companies don't want to exit China unilaterally, but what they will do is look at a China plus strategy. And they'll have manufacturing capacity inside China and aim it more at satiating demand within China, and have then an additional manufacturing site outside to cater to either exports or to more highly secretive manufacturing capacity. Well, India is a clear beneficiary of that, with a large young population and an administration that is very much intent on enhancing the productivity of all those hundreds of millions of young people. And then Mexico is going to be a big beneficiary of friendshoring. And they've nationalized their lithium, and Germany is building an LNG export facility. So on the energy sector, Mexico certainly wants to enhance its own domestic productivity quality, and that's likely to be very beneficial, as well as the potential for factories to relocate away from China to serve the US market. Then the trend of governance in Indonesia is improving, and it looks increasingly likely that Widodo will be replaced in a peaceful election, and will have a clean handoff of power, and that the trend of governance will persist. Now, the MSCI Indonesia ETF was in negative territory in here today, and it is still pulling back from the upper side of this range that's been forming now for most of the last 8 years. And it will need to sustain a move up through 25 to confirm a return to medium-term demand dominance. So I think Indonesia is certainly worth watching. Then Nigeria is another major population center, and there's then also the potential that it will benefit from energy exports. The Nigeria ETF, having it popped on the upside over the last 6 months and has pulled back over the last couple of days, it's probably going to be more of a victim of less liquidity, tighter credit conditions, and it would certainly benefit from a weaker dollar overall, and certainly benefit from higher commodity prices. But the challenge right now, I think, is writ large with the oil price, where we've had this big run-up off the lows in 2020, and then subsequently giving up about half of that advance, And the price is now encountering resistance in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. The sequence of lower rally highs is intact. And I think this is very important that when we think about oil prices, the biggest consumer is China. And what happens in China and in terms of Chinese demand is going to have a material impact on the oil price. And it does look like the oil price is going to fall further from here. And then we can think about the copper price. It broke downwards earlier on this week. So it has now, if there were a midpoint danger line stop, it would have been triggered. It's hovering in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. But the big challenge here overall is that China accounts for more than half of copper demand and considerably more than half of copper processing. And the boosters for a copper bull market, they only want to talk about demand growth and the possibility that the landscape is going to be wallpapered with solar panels and with wind turbines, and that there'll be thousands of miles of cabling required, and it's all going to require tons of copper, and that the demand for copper is going to multiply several times over by the end of the decade, which all sounds wonderful. And then you have the flip side of that, which is that demand growth is not a constant, and during a recession, demand growth evaporates. So even though there is a lot of enthusiasm for the potential, the reality is that China's growth is rolling over. They haven't been as aggressive in supplying liquidity. Chinese bond yields are still contracting and down to 2.7%. So really quite a significant yield divergence between the renminbi and the US dollar. But the bigger picture here is that China's exporting deflation now. So I think it is very likely we're going to have a deflationary shock, that there's going to be this winnowing process that we've looked at in the stock market, the underperformance of commodities, the clear tightening of credit conditions, the fact that energy prices are rolling over. All of that highlights the very clear risk that we are moving progressively closer to a recession, and that there will be, I think, a flight to safety in many regards, and bonds will do better for a time. Subsequently, we'll move into a more liquidity-rich environment. I think at that point we'll see that the winnowing process has run its course, that the clear leaders will be a lot more obvious, and they will probably then fill out a portfolio which could do well over the course of the next decade, even if we are going to have occasional bouts of volatility along the way. And I think that gold is likely to be a big beneficiary throughout this process. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.